Welcome back to Fear or Favour, another very busy week. But we're taking a slight break this week to talk to someone who has got a very interesting case. I say it's an interesting case, of course, it's had huge impact on him, his loved ones, and of course, the people that are directly involved. Very shortly, we'll hear from him himself. But let me just set the scene. So 2011, Jacob Dunn was 19 years old. He was out drinking when he got a call that one of his mates was in trouble. Without question, he went to protect him. That resulted in him landing a punch on a trainee paramedic, James Hodgkinson, age 28. He left the scene and he went on holiday in Tenerife with his mum and brother, totally unaware of the impact of his punch and how that would change his and the person who he punched life forever. On his return, his mum's house was raided by the police, and Jacob was arrested and subsequently charged and convicted with manslaughter. Sentenced to prison for manslaughter, he served 14 months of that sentence, and on release, he found himself homeless, unemployed, struggling to find a sense of purpose. With the help of others, he's now got his life back on track. He's now released a book, which is titled Right from Wrong, My Story of Guilt and Redemption. And let's make it very clear, in no way are we saying what Jacob did was in any way forgivable. It isn't. He took a man's life. But I think what is really important is this understanding of both punitive and restorative element of the justice system. And before we start to speak to Jacob, that's right, isn't it, Nazir? We have to have a punitive and a restorative element of any sentence.
Yes, we've spoken about that before. I think our system doesn't really deal with the restorative and rehabilitative. It tends to focus very much on the punitive. But Jacob has had a revelatory experience over the last 10 years, and I've had the good fortune of reading his book. It's a very powerful memoir and hopefully a message to people about how the system could be and should be. And of course, you know, as Jacob will say in a moment, he has had privilege, I think, of meeting the parents of the deceased. And he would say, and I'm sure I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but you know, that they changed his life. And so let's you know, rather than you and I talking about Jacob as if he's not in the room, let's talk to Jacob. Jacob, thank you very much for giving up your time today, and of course, congratulations on your book. Tell us a little bit about what your understanding of the last 10 years has been.
Well, thank you for having me and for the introduction. It's definitely been an eventful life. I don't know too many people who write memoirs before they turn 30 years old. Unfortunately for me, that's meant a lot of heartache and met a lot of trauma, a lot of pain caused, especially in the last 10 years of my life.
Jacob, let me take you back to the very beginning. So that let me take you back to that night. And you were out, obviously having a very good time with your friend, and he called for your help. As you turned up and you saw he was in trouble, what thoughts were going through your head in terms of resolving this?
Well, unfortunately, I hadn't learned the skills to resolve any conflict in life. And the only way I'd learned how to resolve conflict up until that point, especially when it involved my male peers around the same age as me, was to use fear and intimidation as a way to resolve your problems.
And violence?
And violence, obviously, yes, it is involved in that. And so for me, I wasn't even interested in what the altercation was about, why there was even an argument in the first place, which is the advice I give to any young person now is, you know, you need to be clear before you're making any decision, especially getting into confrontation.
And would you say as you approach that, and we often hear the word red mist, would you say that you'd lost context of what was going on around you? You just saw one thing?
Yeah, I just knew that my friend had asked me for help, and I was more concerned about my reputation with them and getting brownie points from my friends for being there to protect each other. We'd often get into fights on nights out at weekends, and it was all quite a camaraderie experience whenever we got into a group.
So was this a status thing? Was this about, yeah, you know, losing face?
It's completely all about status. It's all about, you know, wanting my friends to know that if they're in trouble, they can rely on me at any means or for any reason, which is just completely, you know, ridiculous talking about it now, 10 years on. But back then, all I really cared about were my peers, because I felt like they were the only ones that really cared about me, or the ones that really understood me, because we'd all dropped out of school together. We'd all kind of were fighting the system before we were even locked up in the system.
Mm.
We were rebelling against teachers. We were rebelling against community support officers, social workers.
Just picking up on that before we move forward, and Nazir, it'd be interesting to see what your thoughts. What do you think could have changed that view? I mean, why were you fighting the system? What was it that was making you so angry and disillusioned with the system that you were trying to take it on?
For me, and I mentioned this in the book, I think the main transition period was from when I went from primary school to secondary school. I hadn't really had those values embedded as a primary school student. You know, I was a good learner in primary school. I didn't have an issue with authority. And I guess once I got into a more disciplined, strict, socially vulnerable, because I think any teenager going into secondary school is kind of trying to work out, you know, what friends to make, and more interested in that side of things. And I ended up becoming the class clown in school. I didn't understand the benefits of education in school, because it's all kind of mandatory. You have to read this. There's no kind of critical thinking element to any of it. There's no real debate, not in my experiences anyway. And a lot of young people in my inner city school had very negative attitudes towards education. So it was seen more as a place to just mess about. And
Jacob, I'm interested. Who would you see as a role model at at that time?
Probably the older drug dealers in my area.
The older drug dealers. What do you think about that, Nazir? I mean, that's shocking,
well, isn't it? I mean, exactly. I mean, if you don't have role models that can guide you, advise you, then you will attach yourself to those that you think can do. And Jacob's experience, unfortunately, is not rare, is it? And he was dragged along. You said earlier on, Jacob, about status. What was important to you is how you were seen by others, particularly your peers, and that the fact that you were, you know, you were violent and you were strong, etc. All of those things were really important to you, and nobody taught you how to diffuse tension. Nobody taught you to deal with hostility other than in the way that you did. And
no one had taught me how to even recognize how I was feeling, or how to talk about how I was feeling, and how to navigate uncomfortable emotions. I often say I probably had the range of emotions of angry, sad, and happy, as like that was my emotional vocabulary. And so I would often get frustrated for that reason, because one, I had no experience of healthy communication. I didn't have any healthy relationships. And I had this kind of toxic, kind of friendship group in which we all kind of groomed each other down that path.
Jacob, I want to move forward. There's an awful lot that I know Nazir and I want to talk to you about, but let's just move forward. So you strike one punch.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, you end up with the individual killing them, and they end up dying. So James Hodgkinson, as a result of your single punch, dies. Did you think at that moment in time, was there anything going through your head thinking this could have consequences?
No, not until I actually threw that punch.
And having thrown the punch, what did you think then?
Having thrown the punch, I realised that he had fell over unconscious. And at that moment, I just ran away from the scene. And I think deep down, I was a bit panicked and scared. Because I know it doesn't make any sense, but although I threw a punch, what I was trying to symbolize in that punch was that I was there for my friends, and not necessarily because I wanted to inflict a significant amount of harm on that individual. So once I realized that there had been more harm than I had intended, I panicked and ran away from the scene.
So you knew it was serious, but at that stage, I'm assuming you didn't know that you'd killed him.
No, I had absolutely no idea.
What happens that night? You go home. Are you worried? Do you think that the police might come and arrest you?
Yeah, I was scared. I tried to make my way home without being detected by the police. And I was also in the middle of Nottingham city centre, so was aware that, you know, probably everything had been picked up on CCTV camera. And so it was just going through my head. Everything was going through my head in terms of an evidential point of view, is it? And where I stood in terms of, I don't know, liability and being caught.
So you go home, you go on holiday the following day. When do you find out that you killed James?
I didn't go on holiday the following day. I went a couple of weeks later. But what did happen is my friends came round the next day in the morning to my house, and they were all, I popped my head out the bathroom window, which was above the living room, the front door, and they were all congratulating me. They were like, yes, Jacob, you knocked that guy out one punch last night. We're going to, you know. And so I was getting validation, which is what I just mentioned is what I wanted from throwing punches and from protecting.
You still didn't know he was dead, though, did you, Jacob? So
I still didn't know he was dead. I think someone at the scene had texted me and said that an ambulance had come and that he had become conscious.
Yeah.
So I thought nothing of it from that point, and it was just another night, another fight.
And when did you know he died?
I knew he died when the police were arresting all my friends on suspicion of murder.
So had you gone away? Had you gone away on holiday, or was it before you went away?
It was when I got back from holiday.
Right. So you got back. You then discovered that all your friends had been arrested or were being arrested.
Were being arrested. Yeah, I had a phone call from one of my friends who was at work, and he was one of the few that actually had a job. So when the police raided his house, or his mum's house, he wasn't there. So he gave me a call and said the police have raided my house. I don't know why, but he said he said I've got a funny feeling it might be about that night when you punched that guy. And so that was when he planted the seed in my head. And I was like, why would he think that? That was weeks ago. But then obviously it became apparent that that's what it was, that they were arresting my friends for. And because my friends were more well-known to the police than me, that's why they were all being arrested.
Jacob, did you make no effort after that, in between, before being arrested, to find out what had happened to him? Did you not look on the internet? Did you not look to try and find out?
I didn't know a name.
Okay. But did you make any efforts to see whether there was any reporting of a death?
I did after I was arrested. I was like, as if I had never heard anything about this, as if it wasn't in the local press or... And I'd looked, and I think there was just a brief local newspaper article that mentioned it.
So is it fair to say, and I'm not, this isn't me being cruel, it's just me doing my job. Is it fair to say that having thrown that punch the following day, you kind of thought, well, you know, good, my mates think I'm great, move on. Not pay much attention to it.
Yeah, definitely.
I think the way you described it, another night, another fight.
Yeah, another night, another fight. And I myself had been bottled. People tried stabbing me, you know, been on the floor with, you know, other gangs of people stamping on me and kicking me. And over time, as you start getting exposed to this kind of stuff from about the age of 16, really, 15, I just become more and more normalized to violence and detached from how bad things can go.
It got serious, though. It got serious. Now the police have got you in the police, in the station. They've told you you're arrested on charges of murder. How do you feel now?
Oh, awful. I can't even... it's so hard to kind of put into words. It's just pure panic, disbelief. And also the thoughts for the first time started creeping in that this isn't really what I wanted. I didn't want to go to prison. And I started to realise that I actually had some ambitions for my life. And those ambitions, I guess, were, at that point, were not to be in prison for the rest of my life. And I guess that's what young people don't get told by their elders who are involved in criminality.
So were you remanded in custody ahead of trial?
No, I wasn't remanded. I was given... When I was arrested, they were gathering evidence. I was in there for 24 hours. They got the extension from the magistrates. But then I think they were waiting on a few other witness statements and some other evidence to come in before they could charge. So they released me on bail for a night, a day. And then when I came back the next day, I was charged with manslaughter. I was arrested for murder, charged for manslaughter. And then I guess my solicitor just did a really good job of saying, you know, he's already been released for a day. He has no previous criminal convictions. As long as we can surrender his passport, put him on an electronic tag, wasn't allowed on the internet.
So you basically got bail after being charged with manslaughter?
Yeah.
A
lot of my black friends in my community did give me a lot of stick for that. They said if it was one of us, lot, we would have definitely been remanded for that.
I think Jacob's probably right about that, isn't he, Mark? Yeah. I think that a little bit of white privilege came in there, Jacob.
Yeah, and I was able to use a bit of white privilege, play on some of my, I had some diagnoses of, you know, being on autistic spectrum and ADHD and stuff in the past. Not having a criminal record, thankfully, you know, I got to 19 years old without being charged with anything previously. So based on all that evidence, I guess.
I mean, it's not unusual, but as I say, people might be a bit surprised that somebody charged with a homicide.
What I would say is that I was my sentencing date was 2 months after that. So I was at home on tag with my mum for 2 months, and that was torture. By the end of it, by the time I was going to sentencing, I'd wished I'd just been remanded, because at least then I would have been able to have been a judge, because I had two months of suspense, not knowing what prison was going to be like, not knowing how long I was going to get. My mum's at home stressing me out every day, thinking my son isn't capable of killing somebody. He must be covering up for his mates who have done it. So she's in my ear constantly, every night, worrying, Jacob, what have you done? Oh, Jacob, what about this other person's mum? And I wonder how they're feeling, because she was a compassionate woman, my mum. She was an Ofsted registered childminder, so she was caring from at the core. So in her mind, she was just thinking, you know, what's this other parent? And what are these other parents going through who have lost their son? Are you covering up for somebody? And I couldn't get out of the house to get away from her because I was on electronic tag. And so by the end of those 2 months, I was actually just grateful to be going to prison.
Jacob, I want to ask you in a minute about the trial and obviously the sentencing. But before that, Nazir, so there are certain crimes to which there is it's basically the process is that you will be remanded in custody unless as a defence you can provide.
Murder is one of them.
Murder and rape are two.
Yeah.
It is, and we've had this, where individuals have been given bail, i.e. not gone to jail, waiting the trial. For those types of offences, as a prosecutor, where is that line drawn?
Well, you know, obviously we follow the law, and the law says that if there's a risk of further offences, they should be remanded in custody. Well, and part of that is the fact that Jacob had no previous conviction, so that risk was probably quite low. Is there a risk that he would fail to appear at court? You know, is he a flight risk? Again, you can deal with that by passports being taken off, by having a stable address, by having a mother that will, you know, look after him, by having him tagged. Is there a likelihood of him interfering with witnesses? Well, no. So they applied the law and came to the view that actually he wasn't a bail risk in that way, and that they could address any concerns they had with the conditions. It's not, as I said, it's not unusual. You just have to follow that process. If you have previous convictions, you're less likely to get bail. If you have the likelihood of running away or not appearing at court, you're less likely to get bail. And if there are plenty of witnesses, then there's a possibility you might interfere with them. Then again, you might be denied bail. But as you said, murder, it's pretty automatically you are remanded in custody, save for exceptional circumstances. Manslaughter, more likely than not that you don't get remanded, subject to the conditions of the type that Jacob got.
Jacob, so you go to trial, you plead guilty, do you, to manslaughter?
Yeah, I pleaded guilty to manslaughter at the earliest possible opportunity.
Okay, and of course, as a result of that, that brings with it benefits of your sentencing.
Yeah, I think it's about a third of the sentence.
I think, just again, people need to, our listeners need to understand that the earlier you plead, the more likely it is that you'll get, it's called a discounted sentence. You know, we shouldn't really talk about it in those terms, but potentially up to 30% off. So if the longer you leave your plea of guilty, the less benefit you get, the less discount you get. So by Jacob pleading guilty at the very first opportunity, he benefited from having pretty much a third of his sentence reduced.
So sentence comes. Tell me how you're feeling on the eve of sentencing.
As I kind of hinted before, I was at the point where I just wanted to start my sentence and wanted to face the music and see.
Do you have an idea what that sentence was going to be?
I think the guidance I was given was anywhere from 3 to 8 years. I'm not sure what the sentencing guidelines are for one punch manslaughter. But in my head, I was preparing for the worst and hoping for the best.
Yeah. So and Jacob's right. That's roughly the sentencing guideline that the judges would apply. You obviously get the discount for your early plea. So your ultimate sentence is about right, isn't it? So, according to sentencing guidelines.
Yeah, I got the lowest end of the guideline.
Yeah.
I had a great probation officer who helped with the pre-sentencing report. I know she felt like...
Did they read out a victim impact statement?
I think, mother. They did read a victim impact statement in the courtroom, and the victims were present. Victims' parents were present in...
How did you feel about that? The fact that they were there and you were beginning to hear how they were impacted by their loss.
Well, when I was in that dock, I knew that the family were there, but I didn't know what they looked like, who they were. There were so many people cramming themselves into the courtroom that I just didn't really know where to look or who was who. So I tended to just look down at the floor once I was in the dock, and as a result of that, I kind of just blanked out. I didn't really hear what was being said. In fact, I didn't even know how long I'd been sentenced to until I'd been took down to the cells to get ready to go on the sweatbox to prison.
Right.
So I was very kind of absent.
You might have been there physically, but mentally you weren't there.
I wasn't there. And I wasn't, because I'd already given a guilty plea. I think the family were slightly grateful that I had given an early plea, because it meant that they weren't going to be drawn out for a big trial. If there was any benefit in any of that, I guess I heard that was some comfort.
So, Jacob, I want to talk about the family in some detail very shortly. But before that, let's just come to the end, really, in terms of the impact on you. You go to jail. What's the first few nights in jail like?
So I was sent to my local prison, which was a bit of a mixture of everything, holding prison, remand, Category B. And it was very intimidating, is what I'd say. Because I was a young person, I was able to have a cell on my own whilst I was in that prison.
And talk to me a bit about that intimidation. You had threats against you? Did you feel scared?
I think I just felt scared. I didn't know, you watch the TV dramas and you get told things from your friends. That you can't let anybody take you for a dick. You've got to be mindful that people could be trying to take advantage of you or trying to see how weak you are. I just kind of kept myself to myself. And I was in my cell 23 hours a day. So you don't really have much opportunity to bump into many people other than when you're going and getting your dinner. And it was bonfire night and the fireworks were all going off that first night that I was in prison. I remember just thinking to myself, almost like those fireworks symbolized society's happy that I was being locked away.
So how long did you do?
I did 14 months in total.
And what rehabilitation did you get whilst you were inside?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Well, they lock you away for 23 hours a day, and then the 1 hour a day is for food and walking around. I mean, Jacob's experience, unfortunately, is very typical.
But therein lies a problem, doesn't it? How are you, if you go to jail as a young man who's clearly got behavioural problems, in terms of attitude and anger, and you're locked away in jail for 14 months and nobody takes you and sits down with you and says, let's address this issue. That is a failing, is it not?
Absolutely.
Well, I had a prison officer come and get me from my cell one day. And what he'd done, he printed out all the newspaper articles about my sentencing. And he printed off all the comments that the public had made on the articles and basically said, look, this is what everybody thinks about you. Look at what you've done. How does that make you feel? And I basically just told him to fuck off. And that was about it.
So did he do that off his own back? Was that part of some kind of process?
That was part of some sort of process. I think he was my personal officer. Right.
And you told him to fuck off?
Yeah, I told him to fuck off.
So I get a sense of you sitting in jail, angry.
Very angry.
Fighting the system still.
What did happen is the friend who I had the call from to come and help, he was the one who ultimately gave the witness statement that led me to have to plead guilty. So what, you know, in prison terms, he snitched on me. And so that was the perfect excuse for me not to take any accountability, because I could just blame him for the fact that I was in prison, that he had broken our code of conduct. And unfortunately, everybody else in prison shares those values. So if someone was to ask me what happened to me and in my sentence, as soon as I told my fellow peers in prison that my friend had snitched on me, they reinforced those values within me that I should feel angry and I should feel...
They gave you somebody else to hate.
They gave me somebody else to pin all my blame on, rather than taking any accountability for the fact that...
And Jacob, you were convicted solely, so there's no joint enterprise here, is that right?
No, there's no joint enterprise. There were other people arrested to begin with, but once they gathered all the information, it would have been a bit of a stretch for them to have been co-conspirators, even though I guess they started the argument and called me to the scene. But
so, Jacob, you do your sentence, you come out, and where you are now is a very different place. I want to kind of understand at what point you started to realise that actually you needed to address your issues. You needed to turn this around completely and understand the impact on the victim and the victim's family, James and his family. But when did that start to happen and why?
It was a couple of months after I got out of prison. I was trying to get back on my feet. One day I went to go and see my probation officer, and she introduced the first time I'd ever heard of restorative justice to me. And she said that basically the parents of the man I'd punched wanted to ask me some questions about what had happened, and that I was the only person that could possibly answer those questions. And I guess that was the first time that I started to come to terms with the fact that I wasn't the victim in this situation, which is what I kind of felt like I was up until that point, because I was blaming the snitch who snitched on me, because I felt unfortunate that of all my friends who had thrown punches and everyone else that I'd witnessed ever throwing punches on drunken nights out, that it was my punch that led to a man passing away.
Just on that, I mean, Jacob, that's it's quite a powerful statement. You didn't have to go through restorative justice. It's not compulsory. So what made you agree to meet with the parents?
I guess it was a moral decision. Even before I went to prison, my mum had always kind of been asking me, you know, imagine what the other parents are going through who've lost their son. And that was a very uncomfortable thought for me to have. And when that prison officer showed me all the newspaper articles about what had happened, that was very difficult to think about. And I guess I tried to think about it, but how could I ever... I'd never been through grief up until this point. I'd never experienced a bereavement of my own. And for me to think about the man who had passed away without any information about who he was as a person was almost torture for me to even try and consider, because I didn't know what to do with that information. I didn't know how to process thinking about my real victims and how they might be thinking, because all I would be doing is coming up with theories as to how they might feel. Or
Jacob, I want to talk about your meeting in a minute, but Nazir, just for the benefit of our listeners, restorative justice, how does it work?
Well, it's about 2 decades old, but it's less understood, and it generally is used for not as
well. It wasn't around when I was in the police force. It didn't exist.
No, it's right. It's not rocket science. The idea is that the individuals who are guilty of a crime should face up to the impact of their crime by meeting with those who've been impacted by their crime. It's ordinarily used for lesser offences. So I've had it myself. I remember I was being attacked online for when I was in role 10 years ago, and I agreed to meet, rather than that individual being prosecuted, which is where it's more often used. I wanted to meet with the individual to make that person aware of the impact of what it was they were doing, and it had a very, very significant impact on them, and I hopefully changed their way of thinking. So more often than not, it's used instead of criminal proceedings. More and more so, and Jacob's a classic example of that, it's being used to assist in the rehabilitation of offenders by getting them to appreciate the impact of their crimes. It's still a small number of occasions. It's pretty poorly resourced, Mark, and so there aren't many, many times when it is being used, but as we're going to hear from Jacob, how important it is that it is used, there is no doubt in my mind that it has a significant effect.
So restorative justice, it's a shame that it isn't used more, because I can just see such a value from it, both in terms of...
We've spoken before, the prison is a revolving door. Offenders go in, like Jacob, they're locked away for 23 hours a day. There's hardly any rehabilitation. They come out, they go back into the same gangs and groups they were in. They commit crimes and they come back and keep doing it over and over again. And that is extraordinarily expensive in every way. However, we know that restorative justice has a significantly high success rate in getting offenders to be confronted by what they've done, by hearing the impact of what they've done. And that is what so often changes their ways. And so it's not only is it the moral thing to do, it's a very strong business case for it. Mm. You know, it costs, I don't know what the latest figures are, tens of thousands of pounds a year to keep people locked up. And we could save all that money if we spent a bit more of it on restorative justice, which is poorly resourced, there's a bit of a postcode lottery. It happens in some parts of the country more often than other parts of the country. But it
is a resource issue, isn't it? Because what worries me, and listening to Jacob, he talks in terms of, you said, locked up in your cell 23 hours and he does 40 months and he comes out and no one sat down and talked to him. Why? Why is that still happening? Why is it just a matter of money?
Yeah,
the government need to apply money to people to...
There is no other reason why it doesn't happen. It's just not properly resourced. There aren't enough probation officers. There aren't enough managers of restorative justice. And so it happens on an ad hoc basis rather than as a systemic way. And if it did work on a systemic way, you know, and I know, it would have a massive impact on crime.
Why are we still in this position? Why hasn't nobody, why is the prisons minister, why haven't previous governments looked at this?
So I recently gave evidence to an all-party parliamentary group into restorative justice. And there were a few reasons why it's kind of... One is an educational point of view in terms of the public. You know, they don't actually know... Victims aren't actually aware that they have the right to restorative justice. And they also don't fully appreciate what it actually is. So there's kind of a messaging problem in terms of... and a public awareness problem of what it is and whether people are actually entitled to it. The other problem is it's not been professionalized enough. And so the restorative justice sector often relies majoritarily on voluntary sector. People, volunteers wanting to become restorative justice practitioners. But obviously in those, and the other thing is there's a lot of charities providing these services with volunteers who, one, can't, it's not been professionalized enough from the prisons minister and whoever else is responsible for making these services more
mainstream and professional.
And the other thing is that the funding is often, it comes through the police and crime commissioners, and they pick and choose how big the pot is for any given area within the country. And the turnaround time, often the contracts are awarded for maybe a year, 2 years. So then another provider will come in another 2 years. And so any work that they've done in building trust within communities and with victims kind of gets lost. And so you get this postcode lottery of some areas within the country that are delivering really good quality restorative justice services for victims of crime in their areas, and in other areas, services being inadequate and at times potentially more damaging to offenders and victims within the process. The other point, by it being quite new, it's a cultural issue, restorative justice. The concept of it is, we tend to feel, and we're told every election cycle, that in order to solve crime, you've got to be tough on crime. And restorative justice and communication and offering offenders a lifeline to be redeemable doesn't go hand in hand with that party rhetoric, whether you're on the left or the right. It doesn't seem like a vote winner trying to kind of get people to no longer reoffend, when in reality, that's all we should be wanting from our criminal justice system, is that it has more, there's more chance of people leaving prison and not coming back, which is obviously not the case. And that's because our criminal justice model is based mainly on the logic that deterrence works. If you make prison hard enough and tough enough, it will prevent people from wanting to go back, and it will force them to want to change their lives. And unfortunately, statistics and research shows that logic only works on people who have something to lose, who have a good job, who have a family, a good supportive family network. And the problem is that most of the people who are coming in and out of prison
don't have any.
It's not a deterrent. When prison is not a deterrent, and yeah,
you know, most people want to be in. Some people want to be in prison, or they find it safer being in prison than it is in their own communities, or they have more friends in prison than they have in their own community.
Absolutely, Jacob. The sooner politicians wake up to the fact that prisons isn't a deterrent. Let's go back to that night you met the family. I just want, and there's a couple more things that we need to talk about, so if you can make it quite tight. But you're meeting the family. I just want to understand what was going through your head, and I want you to understand, and then want you to tell me about that meeting itself. So what were you thinking whilst it was going on, and how were they behaving?
So when I first heard from them, we didn't feel comfortable meeting face to face straight away. I know David and Joan initially said that they could maybe envision seeing me in about 10 years time. But in reality, it took 2.5 years of dialogue before we met face to face.
And this is mum and dad. This is
mum and dad, yeah.
So when you did meet with them, you've sort of built up some kind of rapport through other means of communication. You've met with them. How did that meeting go?
That was a very powerful meeting. They were able to sit there across the table from me and tell me exactly the impact that it had, again, because they told me through dialogue and through facilitation. But it was important for them to be able to sit there, look me in the eyes and tell me exactly what the impact was like. Tell me a little bit more about James as a person, what his personality was like, things that he enjoyed doing, which I would never have ever been able to know unless I took part in restorative justice. And it just cemented everything that I had been doing in those 2.5 years to try and turn my life around. And what was also great towards the end of that meeting is that they wanted to support me to raise awareness that one punch can kill, and to raise awareness more broadly of the benefits of restorative justice, and that other people should at least be able to.
When you went into that meeting, Jacob, did you have any thoughts in your mind to think, and I appreciate you had dialogue with them before, so it may have been something that you were thinking earlier. Did you think about it and think to yourself, they hate me, and they justifiably they could hate me, and maybe they can never get beyond this?
And I had no expectations whatsoever that they should forgive me, or that they would even want to wish me well. But all I really wanted to do was to at least answer the questions that they had and listen to them and take that all on board and try and move on with my life.
What kind of questions did they ask you?
They asked me questions like, had I ever had combat sport training, or have I ever done boxing, or just to kind of get a sense of, you know, the one punch aspect, had I had training in that regard? Had James spoke to a girl maybe that I was with, or spilled a drink on me? You know, just like they weren't quite sure what happened from my point of view as to what had happened. Just lots of questions like that, just trying to piece together from my point of view why I did what I did and what happened leading up to it.
And do you think they made sense of that? Do you think that made sense to them?
Yeah, I think it made sense to them, because I even though my responses were, in my point of view, inadequate, I had to tell them that no, that their son hadn't done anything like that to offend me, and it was purely because my friends had caused an argument with this on and egged me on to get involved in a violent way. That was hard for me to tell them, but it was also useful for me to come to terms with.
So you had one meeting with them or more?
I had two meetings with them, and then after that we've spoke publicly at like universities or on media engagements and
do you remain in contact with them now?
Yeah, I still remain in contact with them. It was always important for me to keep them updated on the process of the book, letting them see the manuscripts at each stage, you know, just making sure that was for
how
me.
How did they feel? I mean, that's very interesting. How did they feel about you writing a book?
They were happy that I was writing a book. And I said, you know, I'll do my absolute best to handle it sensitively and to make it more about what I've done since the punch and the wider, broader issues that I would like to start commentating on and getting involved with moving forward, as opposed to continually going round in circles about something that happened to us all 10 years ago, which we've all, in a sense, moved forward from.
You processed. Yeah, you went to university, didn't you? They encouraged you to go to university?
Yeah, that was what took me back the most, because once I'd answered all their questions, they were more concerned then with what I was going to do with my life. I guess, you know, what does justice look like? And I guess from the questions that they were asking me and where our conversation was leading, it was more important for them that I learned from what I'd done and that I didn't continue down the same path, going in and out of prison, hurting other people, hurting myself. And so for them, it was, so what are you going to do in light of all this information, in light of all this dialogue? What are you going to do with your life? And then obviously I had very, very unhealthy experiences in education, but it seemed like the only option for me was to, because I had nothing to put on a CV and no GCSEs or anything like that. So I said, you know, I would have a go at going back into education. And so I did my GCSEs again, and then the following year I did an access course, which is like the equivalent mature students in to get their A levels. And so within 2 years, I was enrolling in university to study criminology.
And you got a first class honours degree.
Yeah, and then I went on, got a first class honours degree in that. Originally, I wanted to become a social worker, and because of my offence,
you were barred from doing so.
Yeah, I was barred from doing so. All the universities said, you know, you'd probably make a great social worker and we need more male social workers, but basically you're too much of a risk and, you know, maybe give it a few more years and we'll consider you if you apply again. And then I applied for criminology and a lot of those universities rejected me to study criminology as well. So I then ended up having to kind of fight a legal battle based on my human rights for education and the right not to be discriminated against, just to access university education.
So Jacob, it sounds like James's parents have had a huge impact on your life and all credit to them. I can't begin to imagine how as parents you deal with the loss of your loved one when they've been murdered, albeit I've dealt with lots and lots of families. It's never been something that personally happened to me. I take my hat off to them, huge respect. Tell me where you are now. Tell me where you've moved to and what's the message to others?
Well, now I'm 30 years old. I have two children, 4 and 2. And so trying to be a good dad, model the things I say I value in terms of my own communication skills with them, working full time. And the messaging in the book, I guess what I'd hope to achieve more broadly is just that people be both more accountable to themselves, but also kinder to themselves, and to put their own well-being first, and to just be honest and be open to asking for help and trying to create more healthy relationships within people's lives. Because I've realized that it's hurt people that hurt people. You know, it's not people who have their lives together and who, you know, are part of healthy communities that are going around destroying communities. And it's people who've lost attachment to communities and aren't part of any positive, healthy communities or relationships. And so for me now, it's just about spreading those messages. And that if I can make those changes from the place that I was in to be where I am now, as a, you know, hopefully in the eyes of people a positive contributing member of society, bringing up my own children now, that it can be done. You know, as long as you're willing to be accountable for where you've gone wrong in the breakdown in your relationships in your life, and to be, you know, not beat yourself up, which as men tend to do, that we can find our way through some of these difficult situations that we all inevitably will find ourselves in at some point in our life.
Jacob, you've done very well. Thank you so much for coming and talk to us. Remind us the title of your book.
It's called Right From Wrong.
And it's available from HarperCollins, online and in all good bookshops, as they say. As I said, I've read it. I think it's a really powerful memoir. Thank you so much, Jacob, for sharing your book and your story with us. And I do hope that people realize the importance of rehabilitation and restorative justice and, as you say, accountability. I love that statement about it's hurt people that hurt people. We realize that people just don't become bad. You know, something happens. So we need to try and do what we can to prevent that happening in the first place.
Exactly. And that me having children of my own really brought that home to me, is that, you know, we're all clean slates as children. Yeah. And we're all innocent, and things go wrong as we navigate life into adulthood. And we've got, but our inner child is always still in there. And sometimes I have to remind myself that I need to speak to myself how I would speak to my children, and have more care.
Jacob, thank you so much for coming on. Please continue to spread the message, and let's hope that as a result of such a horrible, horrible, tragic incident, some positivity comes out of it. Thank you. Nazir, I mean, some hard bits to listen to then, wasn't there? And yeah. You can see the transition from Jacob when he first committed the offence, which was about him being the victim, to moving towards understanding that actually he wasn't the victim in any way at all, and the damage he's done to other people's lives.
No, absolutely. It just goes to show what can be achieved. And, you know, in a relatively short space of time, within 10 years, you know, Jacob's turned his life around to the point where he's now contributing a substantial amount to society, that he's bringing up his own family. He recognizes that he wasn't the victim. All of those things that we know happen, not just in Jacob's case or in serious crime, but other crimes too. We can do so much more to prevent crime happening. We can do so much more to rehabilitate. And Jacob's story is a very powerful one for us to acknowledge and to recognize. And hopefully we'll send out and inspire others too.
Brilliant. I couldn't have said it better. Thank you, Nazir. Well, as ever, thank you very much for listening to our podcast. Please tell your friends, please subscribe, and do drop us an email, either with your thoughts or if you want us to cover a particular story. We will get back to everybody that sends us an email. Thank you again. Look after yourselves and have a good week. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kays, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.